Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 223, presenting miscellaneous articles and updating stories covered in previous broadcasts. We're going to plunge right in with a fascinating story that appeared on the cover of the front page, rather, of the Wall Street Journal of Wednesday, March 29th of the year 2000. This is an article by Gary McWilliams and Christopher Cooper, both staff reporters of the Wall Street Journal. It's Dateline Rekem, Belgium, R-E-K-E-M, headlined, Patriot Games, the quote, Colonel, unquote, dangled deals worth billions, but now he's AWOL, subtitled, Big Electronics Firms Lured by Smooth NATO Pitch Now Face Huge Losses, Pigeon Coop at Safe House. And the article reads in part as follows. The man identified himself as a U.S. Air Force officer attached to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, and he dangled a mouth-watering prize. Billions of dollars in contracts for a top-secret NATO project that called for the most cutting-edge computers, software, and services. There were some strings attached. Companies that participated couldn't breathe a word about it to anyone. And in the initial stages of this clandestine project, the gear that companies submitted would be, in the officer's words, quote, tested to destruction, unquote, so prototypes wouldn't be returned. Over 3 years, as many as 90 companies sent tens of millions of dollars worth of equipment to NATO, quote, materials test unit, unquote, labs in Belgium designated by the officer. The companies included some of the most venerable names in electronics, firms such as Electronic Data Systems Corporation, Sony Corporation, 3Com Corporation, Adobe Systems Incorporated, and a unit of Pioneer Corporation. If only they had looked under the man's hat. Calling himself Lieutenant Colonel Lamar Reed, or at other times Lieutenant Colonel A. West, and occasionally tucking his ponytail under his military cap, the man appears to have pulled off a breathtaking swindle. Based on bankruptcy court filings in Belgium, and on estimates by law enforcement officials and some of the suppliers involved, losses may total $50 million or more, most of it from gear that either isn't expected to be recovered or is now unusable, such as the stack of droppings-encrusted flat-panel displays authorities recently found in a Belgian pigeon loft. The man has dropped out of sight, and his true identity and even his nationality are unclear. Investigators say there is no Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Lamar Reed, although they know who the alleged swindler has used for one of his many identities. There is no Air Force Lieutenant Colonel A. West, either. Like many alleged swindles, this one was, in hindsight, amazingly simple. Claiming to head procurement for a project that would contract for as much as $120 billion of equipment over 5 years, the man persuaded the companies to send for testing tons of their most advanced handheld transmitters, digital disc makers, and video cameras. The companies even had to pick up shipping charges. Herb Rourke, R-O-R-K-E, chief executive of audio storage equipment maker Rourke Data Incorporated, says requiring companies to sign non-disclosure documents was the key to the scheme. Quote, it was the perfect scam, unquote, he says, with a trace of admiration. Again quoting, we weren't allowed to talk about it, unquote. Rourke Data also was required to scrub all identifying labels from the $850,000 of storage equipment it shipped to two purported NATO labs in case the equipment was seized in battle. The ersatz Mr. Reed may have known just what he was doing in going after makers of ultra-high-end audio and video gear. That industry has been beset by slumping sales as manufacturers bicker over various formatting standards. Many of the companies embrace the NATO procurement as a godsend. For instance, the project called for 75,000 copies of a special effects software package, though the software developer's For instance, the project called for 75,000 copies of a special effects software package, though the software's developer estimates the total worldwide demand for such programs at just 30,000 units. It also called for 10,000 digital video editing systems, the kind that cost $150,000 each, an unheard-of bonanza for manufacturers such as Avid Technology Incorporated and Acom, A-C-C-O-M Incorporated, which have been buffeted by an industry slowdown. Now, however, many of the companies are so red-faced that they aren't going after Mr. Reed. Computer services giant Electronic Data Systems recruited as many as 60 companies for the project. It hasn't filed any criminal complaints and listed only a $10 loss in a preliminary claim in a Belgian court, even though EDS faces lawsuits from two companies that allege they sent equipment to Mr. Reed's, quote, testing, unquote, centers after being brought into the project by EDS. Skipping down. What Belgian authorities know about Mr. Reed is that he appeared in 1994 at a tiny bank branch in the rural town of Genk, spelled capital G-E-N-K, dressed in a U.S. military uniform. He met Crystal Peters, manager of the bank branch, and told her he was a fighter pilot. They married, had a child, and settled in a two-bedroom apartment in Rekem on the German border, about 60 miles east of Brussels. Skipping down again. Belgian corporate records show in 1995 Mr. Reed, his wife, and a woman Mr. Reed introduced as his cousin, Patricia Reed, founded a company that would become AMS Laboratories NV. Later, they started another firm, Applied Technologies NV. Skipping down again, speaking of electronic data systems, EDS suppliers say they were told that black hole money, unquote, from secret government budgets would fuel the project. At Mr. Reed's insistence, EDS and Envisage required each company to sign forms barring them from discussing the deal. Talking, the companies were warned, would immediately disqualify them. EDS, the Dallas Computer Services Company, whose founder Ross Perot was fond of hiring retired military officers, provided the credibility of a big-time government contractor. As it passed along Mr. Reed's escalating demands for products and information, EDS emphasized its own legacy as a military supplier and boasted of NATO supply authorizations dating to 1992. It didn't have to embellish. EDS's board includes Dick Cheney, a former U.S. Defense Secretary, and James A. Baker III, former U.S. Secretary of State. Skipping down again. Other little touches also added an air of authenticity. On occasion, Mr. Reed, posing as the colonel, would alert companies, usually by fax, that there would be a blackout, unquote, on communications about the project for weeks or months while he attended to pressing military duties in the Persian Gulf, Bosnia, and Kosovo. Keith Oliver, London-based lawyer for Envisage, said Mr. Reed once returned a shipment of electronic equipment with apparent battle scars, unquote, to leave the impression that the equipment was damaged during field testing in the Kosovo conflict. Mr. Oliver says Envisage executives also met, at Mr. Reed's behest, with other people, quote, who were attired in proper military uniform, unquote, to discuss the project. They all seemed legitimate. Mr. Oliver says, quote, there was no question we were dealing with the real thing, unquote, and skipping down. In fact, keeping the equipment may be exactly why Mr. Reed was able to carry on for so long. Executives from several companies say the very appearance of such sophisticated and expensive equipment on the market would have set tongues wagging. And for Mr. Reed, keeping the scam going may have been precisely the point. As one company executive notes, quote, most of what he had couldn't be sold. It was like he just enjoyed the sport of it, unquote. Well, I can't obviously say exactly who this person was or what their motive was or perhaps on whose behalf the, quote, Mr. Reed or Colonel, quote, Colonel Reed or, quote, Colonel West was operating. But it certainly appears that there was a whole lot more to this than met the eye. What met the eye was officially a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Air Force, and that quite clearly was not what this was. One of the possibilities that has to be considered is that this was, in fact, some sort of deep cover government operation, which was meant to be deniable. That's a possibility I wouldn't rule out. Another possibility, one that I suspect is somewhat more probable, would be that this was some sort of espionage scam and an attempt to acquire high-tech equipment by another entity. Perhaps in other countries, say perhaps Germany, or perhaps what I call the Underground Reich, Nazi elements associated with the powerful Bormann group that I've spoken about in the past. I would note in that regard that the place in Rekem, Belgium, where this particular scam was located, the epicenter of it was on the German border. This would have permitted easy transport back and forth from Belgium to Germany. I would also note that the cover used here, electronic data systems, was a very good one. And it looks like the sucking sound that Mr. Perot used to talk about with U.S. jobs being sucked across the border, in this case, applies to electronic data systems and some of their equipment and some of their business contacts and credibility being sucked over the border to Belgium and, who knows, eventually perhaps across the border to Germany. One wonders whether perhaps some of the finest technology is now in hands high hostile to the United States, that is a very unsettling possibility. I would note in this regard that the Cold War is long over. And one of the things that American political science on all shades of the political spectrum don't seem to have taken into account is that the major struggle now is between what I call Germania and Anglo-Saxonia, basically between Germany and its allies in the underground Reich, and also, and on the other side, the United States, the United Kingdom, and the forces associated with them. This is a struggle, the implications of which are not to be misunderstood or underestimated, and simplistic ideologized thinking is to be avoided at all costs. I've spoken about that in the past, and one of the things that I've spoken about this in connection with this struggle, that is the heat that's being put on the not only the Echelon network, an electronic espionage network jointly managed by the United States and the United Kingdom, but in particular the Menwith Hill installation in the United Kingdom. As I've said in the past, the many, many shortcomings of both U.S. and British intelligence notwithstanding, and those are not to be underestimated either, the fact of the matter is that the Menwith Hill installation and Echelon network are absolutely essential to the national security of this country. I don't think signals intelligence, frankly, is any of the public's damn business. The public can't even figure out its own business, as the collapse of the stock market this past Friday gave ample evidence. In fact, the U.S. economy has been very unhealthy for a long time. We'll perhaps touch on that at the end of the broadcast if we have time, but let's just say the people that can't manage their own finances have no business even attempting to deal with signals intelligence in a concrete fashion. I would also point out that the underground Reich and elements of associated with it would certainly want to compromise Menwith Hill, the National Security Agency, and other installations and institutions that would perhaps interfere with their operations. And I would also alert people to the Serpent's Walk book that deals with a takeover of the United States in the next century by the descendants, actually in the 21st century, that's this century, around the middle of the century, by the descendants of the SS who go underground, infiltrate the U.S. Army after gaining control of the U.S. opinion-forming media. There is an attack by genetically engineered organ microorganisms of ostensibly Russian origin, which wipes out much of the United States and much of the world's population, including the President and Vice President of the U.S. The Speaker of the House then becomes President of the United States, declares martial law, and invites the underground Reich into a governing coalition, and they promptly take over. Not in superficial respects, unlike the way von Hindenburg invited Hitler to become Chancellor of Germany. He then staged the Reichstag provocation and took over. A very interesting story about the continuing heat on the Menwith Hill installation was carried also by the Wall Street Journal, this from the Wall Street Journal of Friday, March 31st of the year 2000. This is an article by Michael Shishkin of the Wall Street Journal. It's datelined Brussels, and it's headlined, "Lack of Evidence Hobbles Calls for Probe of U.S.-UK Spy Setup." This article reads in part as follows. Some groups in the European Parliament are clamoring to launch a formal inquiry in April into allegations that the U.S. and the United Kingdom are spying on European companies through the Echelon signals intelligence system. But amid all the political rhetoric, one fact stands out: lack of evidence. Although encouraged by the European Commission, no single company in the European Union has stepped forward with complaints about being snooped on by the Echelon. Quote, "No company has come to speak to us about any injury," unquote. Jonathan Fall, FAULL, a senior commission spokesman, said in response to a barrage of questions about the commission's alleged inaction in the face of commercial espionage. Skipping down, but espionage allegations grew even louder recently when James Woolsey, a former director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, said commercial espionage did take place and that it was justified by the fact that European companies are more corrupt than those in the U.S. Take that with a grain of salt, but I suspect that Woolsey's assertion is correct, but for different reasons. Bear with me and while I finish the article. European companies, or let's say, James Woolsey, a former director of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, said commercial espionage did take place, and it was justified by the fact that European companies are more corrupt than those in the U.S. Responding to these allegations, Mr. Fall, the commission spokesman, said that they are, quote, an outrageous slur, unquote. I think it's preposterous to assert that U.S. companies are less corrupt than those in Europe. I would say that they're essentially neck and neck. They're sort of racing to see who can be more corrupt. However, I would note, I suspect that perhaps beneath Mr. Woolsey's superficial justification of commercial espionage is not only an awareness of the fact that commercial espionage is simply a way of life. The Germans, among others, committed against us. The Europeans committed against us. In the Silicon Valley here, the Siemens firm is the epicenter of German espionage in the Silicon Valley. Around the world, the Goethe Institutes, according to Professor Stauffer, allegedly function as fronts for the Bundesnachrichtendienst, German intelligence, and the United States commits commercial espionage against other countries as well. It is simply, literally, business as usual. I wonder whether perhaps Mr. Woolsey is using a different justification here for U.S. industrial spying. I wonder whether perhaps he's aware of, as I'm sure he is, of the realities of the Bormann Organization and the threat that the Underground Reich presents to the United States, not only economically, but also from the standpoint of terrorism. I think that's something to be seriously considered. As I've said before, as preposterous as this will sound to veteran listeners to the program, I think that the Echelon Network and the NSA, under the circumstances, should be supported by the American people. I will also stress that that is not a statement I feel in the least little bit comfortable making. It is also one that I believe to be correct, perhaps, believe to be right, perhaps incorrectly. Take that as you will. A fascinating story with potentially enormous implications appeared in the Los Angeles Times of Thursday, April 6th of the year 2000. This story may also be incidental. It may not be particularly important. It certainly is interesting, and it may be very important. I've spoken in the past about the role that blackmail, sexual blackmail and other types of blackmail, plays in politics. If one can gain control over somebody, over their habits behind the scenes, whether it's drugs, sex, or what have you, that's a very, very good way of gaining control of them. If they've been involved in financial shenanigans, you can gain control of them. If they've been involved in sexual shenanigans, you can gain control of them. If they've been involved with drugs or what have you, you can gain control of them, and that's a very useful device. We've also spoken in the past about the Presidio child molestation scandal, in which the name of former Army Lieutenant Colonel and psychological warfare expert Michael Aquino came up. Aquino, acknowledged as one of the Army's top psychological warfare experts, is also a practicing Satanist, as the head of a satanic cult called the Temple of Set, with many former and active duty military people as members, including Green Beret, Navy SEALs, former Delta Force members. The Temple of Set's highest order, the Order of the Trapezoid, is patterned on the occultism of the SS. While on active duty with NATO, Aquino was performing SS rituals at Wavelsburg Castle in 1982. That's a castle that was built by the SS for its occult purposes. And I would also note that members of the Temple of Set are required to read Mein Kampf as part of their spiritual upbringing. There have been a number of people who have alleged that Michael Aquino was involved in mind-controlling people for sex purposes, of using them as sex slaves for various powerful political figures. Those allegations against Aquino have been made by people who of both genders, and people who were allegedly used as sex slaves by people of both sexual persuasions, meaning hetero and homo. Against the background of that, consider the following, perhaps irrelevant, perhaps very relevant, again from the LA Times of Thursday, April 6th of 2000. AP story, Dateline San Diego headline, retired Army major charged in child pornography case. Remember also, in connection with the O.J. Simpson case, that Sandpoint, Idaho, a tiny city of fewer than 6,000, it was found to be one of the epicenters of the white supremacist movement. That's discussed in the book Blood Oath. It's discussed in, among other broadcasts, the For the Record segment entitled To Sandpoint and Beyond, and also in the broadcast entitled Where Was Mark Furman on the Night of June 12th, 1994. That's when Nicole Simpson and Ron Goldman were murdered. Mark Furman, himself a white supremacist, moved to Sandpoint, Idaho after his precipitous resignation from the LAPD. Consider the political significance of Sandpoint, Idaho, as one listens to the following. Again, the headline, AP story, Dateline San Diego, retired Army major charged in child pornography case. It reads in part as follows. A retired Army major who oversaw the White House's emergency communications has been charged with sending pornographic material to children over the Internet and attempting to have sex with two girls. John W. Davis, 44, of Sandpoint, Idaho, was caught in an internet sting when police posed as a mother who told Davis he could have sex with her 12 and 14-year-old daughters. Davis was arrested March 23rd after he arrived in San Diego to meet the fictitious mother. Skipping down, Davis was in the Army for 20 years and retired in 1994 as director of the Emergency Actions Branch at the White House. Again quoting, "In the event of a national emergency, he would have been fully responsible for the White House Communications Agency and would have traveled with the president to a relocation center to direct all information service requirements and base operations for the duration of the emergency," unquote, Hughes wrote in the bail request. Skipping down, Hughes said his client is devastated by the charges, which he denies. Hughes said he plans to file a challenge to the laws. And again, skipping down, Davis, who is married and has three children, also worked as the director of the emergency broadcast system, now called the Emergency Alert System, which allows the government to reach the public in emergencies. Well, again, one doesn't not want to necessarily read too much into this particular story, but among the questions that suggest themselves is was the unfortunate former Major Davis subject to blackmail? Were his sexual inclinations known? Was this perhaps held over his head as a political sword of Damocles rather than referring him to the therapy which he needed, which could have perhaps helped him? And also one wonders whether perhaps his presence in Sandpoint, Idaho is more than coincidental. Among the questions that also suggest themselves, is he a white supremacist? Is he part of some sort of clandestine network within the military? Was he perhaps a George Bush appointee, or was he elevated to his position under George Bush? Bush is one of the names that is George Herbert Walker Bush, is one of the names that surfaces in connection with the Franklin cover-up, where some of the suggestions that some of the allegations that Colonel Aquino had been involved in mind-controlling various sex slaves emerged. Again, not a story one can draw any conclusions from, but it certainly is interesting and possibly significant. Something which also bears in mind, it should also be borne in mind in connection with political blackmail, is the following. Many papers carried this story, including the San Francisco Chronicle of Thursday, March 23rd of the year 2000, which I would note buried this on page 8. This is a Washington Post story, datelined Washington, headlined U.S. Reopens Pinochet Probe. It's subtitled Links Sought to Fatal Car Bombing in 1976. The article reads in part as follows. The Justice Department has reopened a long-dormant grand jury investigation, hoping to indict General Augusto Pinochet for a notorious 1976 car bombing that killed former Chilean Ambassador Orlando Letelier and an American colleague on Washington's Embassy Row. Six people were sent to prison years ago for the bombing, but the U.S. government had not singled out Pinochet for prosecution until the former dictator was arrested in Britain 17 months ago on a warrant from a Spanish judge looking into the slayings of Spanish citizens in Chile during the 1970s. Galvanized by the Spanish effort, U.S. human rights activists and victims' relatives demanded that the Justice Department revive its investigation into whether Pinochet ordered the assassination of Letelier, a prominent opponent of his regime. The powerful blast on September 21, 1976, tore through Letelier's car as he drove into Sheridan Circle, killing him instantly and fatally wounding his 25-year-old American colleague, Ronnie Moffitt. The chances that Pinochet, if indicted, would be extradited to the United States to stand trial are remote, given his failing health and a host of legal problems posed by the antiquated extradition treaty between the two nations. But U.S. officials say an indictment would have symbolic value and could ratchet up the pressure on Chile to try Pinochet for human rights abuses during his 17 years in power. I would note that this killing took place in 1976 when George Bush was director of Central Intelligence. This killing, as we've looked at in numerous programs, including Radio Free America program number 19, Radio Free America program number 22, Radio Free America programs program number 30, and others. This also Radio Free America program number 27, Radio Free America program number 30, and others. The assassination of Orlando Letelier was part of Operation Condor. We took a look at that in number 20 as well. Operation Condor was an international assassination consortium run by a group of Latin American military dictatorships with the connivance of elements of U.S. intelligence. And that element of U.S. intelligence that was associated with the Condor countries was the Bush and Reagan faction and the Wackel faction, the former World Anti-Communist League and Galen faction of U.S. intelligence. That's the faction that I refer to as being associated with the underground Reich. If, in fact, there were to be a full probe of the Letelier assassination, that would inevitably lead in the direction of George Bush. And I wonder if the Justice Department probe of the Letelier assassination at this time may, in fact, be directed at embarrassing George W. because of the fact that, obviously, his father would have his name come to light in connection with this action. We've talked about the assassination of Orlando Letelier in the past. I would also note that the Assistant Attorney General, who, according to Donald Freed and Fred Landis in their book Death in Washington, was responsible for covering this up, was a fellow named J. Stanley Pottinger, who for 9 years was Gloria Steinem's paramour. Gloria Steinem, the doyenne of American feminism, herself with a background in the CIA, was Pottinger's lover for some 9 years, and Pottinger was the person who, quote, defended, unquote, Steinem against charges that she was CIA, a boast she made in interviews with the Washington Post and the New York Times in 1967. She said the agency was very good journalistic training. I would note that in the mid-1960s, Steinem was actually run out of the station JM Wave, the CIA station JM Wave in Miami. I would also note in that regard that there were threats against Bill Clinton when he was on his recent trip to Southwest Asia. That from the L.A. Times of Tuesday, March 23rd of the year 2000, Dateline Washington, a Bob Drogan story, U.S. detailed threats linked to Clinton trip. This reads in part as follows. Several terrorist groups have directed threats at President Clinton in connection with his week-long visit to South Asia, including an assassination plot directly linked to accused terrorist leader Osama bin Laden, officials here said Wednesday. The bin Laden family were business partners with James R. Bath, who claims to have worked for the CIA and was the Texas representative for the bin Laden family. James R. Bath was a capital holder in Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first oil company, and it appears from information that we discussed in For the Record Program 182 and recapped in number 186 that the capital that James R. Bath used to invest in Arbusto Energy came from his Saudi clients, which might very well include the bin Laden family. I would note that in this particular context. The various tapes that I've done over the years and that I've alluded to, the For the Record and Radio Free America programs, for example, are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email spitfire@ix.netcom.com. List of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.